Correctly with the correct amount.
D20 Radio, where gamers roll.
www.d20radio.com. Thought for the day, he who picks up the sword against us shall perish by it. Hello, merchants, and welcome to episode 82 of the Grimdark Podcast. This is James.
And this is Mike.
If you're joining us for the first time, we're a podcast devoted to role-playing in the 41st millennium, using the game systems created by Fantasy Flight Games up until now, and whatever may go forward in the future as well. Normally, each episode, we cover a different game system, and today's show will be a Rogue Trader show, though we have a lot of stuff to talk about that's not particular to, well, even the role-playing games, but it's still interesting news. Before we jump into stuff about today's show, it has been a good long while since we last podcasted, actually over a month, I think, so we've been pretty neglected this year, but there's been multiple reasons. I've been overseas in North America, and I did some gaming over there as well. I went to a gaming con, went to a work thing as well. Mike's had a lot of work on. I'm about to start another 3 weeks of straight travel. Literally, I fly out this afternoon as we're recording the podcast. So it's just been hard to find time, and when we have finally found time to get together, we've usually gamed. Yeah, so once again, we put gaming ahead of podcasting.
Yes.
But today, we managed to find time to do a podcast, and we are still alive, we are still going, there's plenty of stuff happening, plenty of news, so we will keep covering it. And what have we done gaming-wise in the last month and a bit? We got back into our D&D game again.
D&D game?
So I thought we were sort of picking up with the second part of the Chronicle, but I think that our GM decided, well, I've forgotten that we had some loose ends he wanted to type for the first part, so...
Yeah.
But that was alright, that was a pretty typical dungeon crawl.
There was a little bit of retroactive changing of the plan.
Yes, that's right, because I recall that at the end of the previous session, we were asked by a dragon to go and clean out their lair, which might have been taken over by someone else, and we're like, you know, and to recover any treasure, and we're like, oh yeah, no, we'll make sure all the treasure is recovered. And we just say, oh, when we come back, we'll say, oh, yeah, there was no treasure. As we're wearing, like, new gold chains and decked out in magic islands. But, no, apparently now the deal is that the dragon was going to meet us at the lair.
At the final chamber.
That's right, yes.
Seems like not such a good deal anymore.
Yes. I'm still running my Numenera game. So I did another session of that last month. And that was also the thing I was talking about in the last episode where I spoke about railroading for a reason. So I sort of had the bit where the module is designed to sort of come to a conclusion or come to an outcome that's... And I did find that when I ran that part of the module, mechanically, it's sort of an unavoidable...
It naturally railroaded?
Yeah, that's it, yeah. I mean, it's pretty much the mechanics of the fight are in such that you can't end up without a particular outcome as such, you know. So
yeah.
I still think it's probably... Like, any time you take agency away from players, it frustrates them. I think it did frustrate the players a bit. But we've moved past that, and we're still playing the game, so...
Oh, that's good then.
I ran my Scion game again, so that's still going well. It's going to go another month before we play that one again, so that's always a game where... Because I don't really plan very much. I sort of run on the fly. I often struggle to remember at the start of each game what happened in the last game as well. So I sort of sent my my players a thing saying, where did the last game end off? And they sort of said, oh, you know, we think that it ended with this sort of, this point. And I said, was there no sort of, I didn't give any sort of impression of impending doom, did I? It was all just happy closure. And they're saying, yeah, it was just closure. There's no doom coming, is there, James? You know, but that went quite well. I ran Mutant Chronicles again just actually 2 nights ago. You couldn't make it, so, because we didn't do D&D because of your work. So I decided to run the second part of the Mutant Chronicles play, which went pretty well. Players still getting their head around the system there. But I also went to two cons in the last month. So I went to Gamination Con in Dallas, Texas, which is run by the D20 Radio Network guys, which we're a part of. So Chris and Dave from D20 Radio run that. I got to play a lot of board games, actually, because I'm used to cons in Australia where you sort of get your schedule worked out before the con starts, you know, all the games you're playing and in what sessions, and it can be relatively hard to get into games along the way because they often fill up during pre-registration. Whereas when I've gone to Game Nation Con in the past, it's been very much a case of, yeah, there are some games pre-planned, but in reality, it's really just
turn up
and someone will say, hey, I'm running this game at this table, and you just go and join in, you know. So because it's run at Dallas Game Marathon, which is sort of like a board gaming store almost, or like it's just like a place you can go to do games. They've got hundreds of thousands of board games on the wall there. And the first night of the con coincided with their regular board game night. I actually ended up playing, so I played the Call of Cthulhu Pandemic version, and I played this game called Attack of the Giants, which is a board game based on 5th Ed D&D that I actually really enjoyed. I think it was a very nicely put together game.
Probably better mechanics than 5th Ed D&D.
You haven't played enough 5th Ed D&D to start bagging it, Mike. Anyway, but
okay,
I think,
definitely better mechanics than 4th Ed D&D.
I did run some Night Witches there as well. Like I ran it at SigCon last year. And I find that's a game system where the more I run it, the better I get at it, because the players, I think, had a really good time that time around. And I also played some other micro systems. Like I played, I think it was called Lady Blackfire's Rebellion or something along those lines, and which is like a two-page system or something. And I played the Kick-Ass and True Bubblegum game system as well, which was a lot of fun. So,
yeah,
yeah, it was good fun. Then I came back to Sydney to Icon, where my 5-year-old son got to role play for the first time. They have a kids' day event there, which is eligible for school age children. So he's in kindergarten this year. So he went to play that, and he had a great time. And then I was supposed to play a session of Shadowrun, but the GM got sick, so I ended up playing a session of Legend of the Five Rings, the
new Legend of the Five Rings,
fifth edition, whatever the most recent AEG edition is before it got sold to Fantasy Flight Games.
So Fantasy Flight Games, they're about to release their new edition, aren't they?
I think there's nothing confirmed about
when the release dates are.
Well, they haven't even confirmed they're doing a role playing game at this point in time, so you can speculate. But I think that so far all I've announced is a card game. But I think they're going to do like a big launch at Gen Con this year. I was talking to Kat Ostrander, who is one of the FFG people responsible for all the licenses that they actually own.
Yep.
So things like Android and Legend of the Five Rings is one of them as well. So I think there's some big launch event happening at Gen Con this year. So maybe we'll find out more about what they plan to do there anyway. So. Yep. So yeah, a lot of gaming in the past month, not a lot of podcasting, but still a lot of important stuff. But anyway, so it is a Rogue Trader show today. We do a news section, then we just need to talk about all the changes happening in 40K at the moment. There's big news going on from Games Workshop, actually literally daily releases of information.
Yeah.
So I'm going to bring you up to speed on what we know so far about the new edition of 40K and the changes to, well, not changes to canon, but the progression of
canon and I think there might be some minor retroactive canon changes.
Oh, it wouldn't be Games Workshop if there wasn't.
Well, there's always going to be.
That's it. In our career discussion, we're on to talking about the Vagabond class Merchant Trader.
Yep.
I'm going to combine our Plot Hooks and War Gear section today into a single conversation. I'm going to review Dawn of War 3, which I've had a chance to play a bit since it was released last month. And my discussion topic for today is about managing the flow of time in your game, as in the passage of time in your game, and also particularly experience gain around long periods of time as well. And then finally we'll do our community section and finish off the show.
Okay.
So after an epic introduction, let's get into the show proper.
Yeah.
Command acknowledged. Accessing Imperial Archives. Okay, onto the news. What I've done here is I've actually changed, because I usually had three news sections: FFG news, Games Workshop news, and Eternal Crusade news. And I've decided to mix this up a bit, change the way this works. So we now have RPG news, Games Workshop news, and computer game news.
Okay.
Because they're all pertaining to the setting as such, and I thought that would keep it fresh as such. Because, to be honest, I mean, like, Eternal Crusade I've just lost a bit of interest in recently, so I'm not really following the weekly videos or the fortnightly videos and such. I'm, you know, just sort of reading the Twitter feed and not playing a lot of it because I have other games that I enjoy playing more, it seems.
Yes.
But anyway, so in terms of the RPG, we've been following Cubicle 7. There's been lots of discussions on their forums. You know, that nobody on their forums has ever stepped in and said, yes, this is happening. No, this isn't happening. But certainly a lot of people are speculating on the Cubicle 7 forums about the new edition of Warhammer Fantasy. So as a reminder, we've still got the situation where still today in Drive-Thru RPG, if you had Warhammer Fantasy items that you'd purchased from Fantasy Flight Games, those items now show a publisher in your library of Cubicle 7.
Yeah.
But the 40K licensed products still show Fantasy Flight Games as the publisher.
Yeah.
So we're just waiting to see what develops there. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe Gen Con we might hear more, or maybe it's even longer if it's waiting on the changeover of what's happening in the 40K game line at the moment as well. But, I mean, they may focus on the role-playing game of Warhammer Fantasy for a bit first, you know, so get that out. And a lot of people are concerned that if they stick with the whole Age of Sigmar thing, it won't be very popular. They're hoping it will go back to the old style, but I don't know. Games Workshop isn't really one for...
They're not going to change their mind about whether Age of Sigmar exists.
Yeah.
It's done.
That's it. Exactly.
They're not going back with that, but you never know.
So on to the Games Workshop side. Now, we've got a lot of stuff happening, which we're going to just put off until the next part of the show. We're going to talk about in our general discussion, but I guess just in regular 40K stuff, we've seen the release of a lot of these Sector Mechanica structures, which are designed for use with the upcoming Shadow War Armageddon book.
Yeah.
So as a reminder, Shadow War Armageddon, or do you want to
Okay, so Shadow War Armageddon was the new Necromunda they were releasing. They released it, it was a box set, and it sold out within a day.
Yeah.
And they were absolutely stunned by the amount of popularity. So they've rushed through a book release of just the rules book.
Yeah.
Plus you can buy some scenery separate.
Yeah.
And that's all coming out very shortly. Yeah. New book, new stuff.
Have you seen the scenery?
Yes.
It looks so much better than the old Necromunda scenery.
The old cardboard with
plastic bulkheads. Yeah, it was the old one was old cardboard platforms with just plastic bulkheads.
Which for some reason sold for insanely high prices still.
Yeah.
They were selling for like $100 a set even just a couple of months ago. But now the new scenery is so much better.
Yeah, I mean, it's even better than... I mean, I bought quite a few of the 40K scenery, like plastic sets you could buy, like the all the ruins, that sort of stuff, you know, and it's much better than that as well. It's like, it's more, they're larger structures, they're multi-tiered, majority plastic, so it looks like they're really good, and you could use them easily in 40K or in the role-playing games if you're using miniatures as well. So
yeah, definitely.
So you're keen, Mike, I think, to get a Armageddon game going.
Yeah, I'm gonna see if I can convince the guys and you to actually take part. I mean, and they've done some really good stuff. I mean, the new Games Workshop exists now, so they've released the rules for most factions free.
Yep.
So you can get that free PDFs on their webpage. So pretty much all factions are represented now.
Okay.
Except for the notable exceptions are Demons and Death Watch themselves.
Okay.
So you can have Death Watch allies for some of the groups, as individual guns for hire, but not as their own faction.
What about demon allies, like summon demons by...
Doesn't exist at the moment.
Okay, demons don't just get together and form gangs and go and start terrorizing.
I think that they're facing the problem of how do you have demons that hang around in the real world for a long period of time to get experience and have a campaign. It doesn't fit canon.
Yeah.
So until they can make a way for it to fit canon, they're not going to.
Okay, no worries. But we're back to the whole changing canon thing again, aren't we?
No, I'm sure they'll bring out something.
Change canon, sell more figures.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, on the computer gaming side now, as I mentioned before, late April we saw the release of Dawn of War 3.
Yeah.
So I think that the next big release we're expecting is Inquisitor Martyr.
They released a new patch for Inquisitor Martyr 2 days ago.
Okay, so did you get it in the end?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so you've been playing it?
Yeah.
I haven't had a chance to really play it since we last chatted about it on the show.
It's changing a lot. Every single time I log in, it seems like something's changed, even though it's just a couple of minor tweaks. But I haven't had a chance to check the new patch, because work.
Yeah.
But
I'll be honest, I got Mass Effect Andromeda, and that was my life, other than work and sleep, for a good few weeks and such, you know. And even the multiplayer has kept me going there as well. It's taken Dawn of War 3 to give me something else to really stick my teeth into for a bit anyway.
Yeah.
So I saw that they have changed the campaign map now for Eternal Crusade, but I haven't had a chance to play that one for a long time now. So I don't know if I just... It's the times I play, but I just can't get into big, good, lasting games and such. So
I think it's where we are. I think part of it is being in Australia. You're sort of limited by the time zones.
Yeah, it's funny actually, because I was travelling recently when I was in the US, and I got onto my office's corporate network when I was there, and I was thinking, wow, this is so much faster than we have in Australia, because in Australia our corporate network runs through Singapore, and Australia's got pretty poor broadband in general. I think we're 30-something in the world as far as network speed goes. And I was talking about, yeah, how good the speed is in North America. And then recently I was on a phone call with one of my co-workers in Germany who travelled North America for work, and he was complaining about how much slower North America was than what he had in Germany. So
yeah.
It's all a matter of perspective, anyway. Okay, well, let's get out of this new section and go into the bigger discussion now.
Okay.
Knowledge is power. Hide it well. All right, then. Let's start by talking about what's happening with Games Workshop, and particularly with 40K. And let's roll it back to outside of the game tech moment and look at the fact that going back to July of last year, July 2016, their share price on the UK Stock Exchange was just over 400 GBP.
Yeah.
And they're now pushing on just under 1,000.
Yeah.
So, you know, their share value has more than doubled in less than 12 months.
Yeah.
So what do you think, Mike, would be the business decisions that are pushing that massive growth? And keep in mind that growth has been, the majority of the growth started in January this year.
Yeah.
So what's changed about GW since January this year?
Okay, so pretty much everything around customer service.
Yeah.
So now they've got Facebook page that actually talks to people. They announce everything they're doing instead of just leaving it to rumours and innuendo, which doesn't really help them. It never has.
Yeah.
Because some stuff would get leaked by staff, but it'd never be the whole story, and people would start complaining about it before knowing the whole thing. So they've changed all of that now. So with the new 40K coming out, they've announced it. We're expecting a release around June, July, which is tax year in UK.
Yep.
Makes sense. And every single day since they announced it was coming, they have released teasers about how the rules work.
Yeah.
Or stuff about the setting and changes. And every time people ask questions, they've answered them. They've started releasing FAQs about all their games and books and everything. And that all started back in January. Well, actually a little bit before January, I think late November.
Okay.
That they've started an FAQ system on 7th edition Tabletop 40K. What can we do better? You know, what are rules, questions and queries that you have? And looking at it now, you can see that the reason they were doing that is to see problems people had with the rules so that they could work on those rules for the new edition. If it's, you know, if everyone's complaining about psychic system being too complicated and why does this work this way, obviously it doesn't work properly.
Yeah.
So they've taken that and they've taken it aboard from what I can see.
Okay. So, I mean, why don't you give us a bit of a run through on some of the major announcements we've heard about 40K since this whole, the new, I mean, it's not just a new edition, it's an update of canon, it's a continuation of the storyline.
Yeah.
And we've been talking in the past about speculations about returning Primarchs, and we've already seen that confirmed with the reappearance of the Ultramarines Primarch. You know, what are some of the big things we're looking at here?
Okay, so we'll cover setting stuff rather than rule stuff first.
Okay.
I'll get into the rules, but setting stuff, the Eye of Terror has grown. They now call it the, you know, it's got a fancy Latin sounding name, but the Eye of Terror covers essentially the entirety of the galaxy. It cuts it straight in half.
Okay.
So on the Terror side of it, it's bad, but it's not unwinnable. On the other side of it, it's much, much worse. So with the spread of that, there are sectors where there are time dilations and changes because the whole warp travel affects time thing, and now the warp's bled in a lot more. Time everywhere is being affected, so some planets are centuries ahead of the rest of the galaxy and some have slowed down to a crawl, and I think they'll probably find ways to bring stuff from the past. Okay. into the current setting through time dilations, and it's a, you know, easy way to explain things which are supposed to be gone coming back.
So dust off your old rhinos and dreadnoughts.
Yeah, possibly.
the golf ball style dreadnoughts. Yeah.
Oh, the golf ball on legs dreadnoughts. Yeah, and your old robots where you have to plant. No, I don't think that's coming back. Other setting stuff that's changed. The new emperor, well, he's not really the emperor, but the know, the Ultramarines Primarch, he's taken over, and he's declared a new crusade across the galaxy to reclaim the Imperium of Man.
Yeah.
He's going to retake everything he can, and he's, part of it is he's going to have a new, better space marine that's going to come forward and help him, and they've got plans to fix that. I don't know the exact details because they haven't covered it, and what else have we got?
Oh. Sorry, you were saying it before the break. What's your speculation about the new, better space marine?
I think it's just going to be an excuse they've got to say, oh, we've got these new, better space marines that work mechanically exactly the same as the old space marines, but we can do it to anyone and we can do it much faster, so we can have more space marines, and oh look, it now can work on females, and that way they get to get rid of the old bugbear that's always chased them with people complaining why are there no female space marines. Yeah. I'm not going to say they're going to retroactively change it.
Even if they have a good reason to put in, it will still cause the, you know.
Oh, it's going
to. Like, I said to you before, like, it'd be funny if they sort of implied that the reason that they were better was because they were female. There'd be people. There'd be an old fashioned book burning.
Yeah. You know? Listen, this is my speculation.
Yeah.
But I see it as the perfect opportunity to change something which is a bit boys' toys old fashioned.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of get into the new century.
Well, just as an aside there, so I mean, I mentioned before in the intro that I took my son to a role playing convention over the last month, and I noticed that the Kids Day thing was for kids aged in Australian primary school, so age 5 to about 12.
Yeah.
And the number of girls participating in that group was actually probably twice the number of boys participating in that. Now, I mean, keep in mind that you only knew about this convention if you were a role player already. So it's role playing parents bringing their kids along, you know. So
role playing parents bringing potential future role players.
That's right, yeah. But I mean, it's become a much more inclusive hobby now. And even once again, the cons have been too. It's a good gender mix. Wargaming, I think, has still failed to failed to penetrate that sort of gender barrier as such. You know, it's not the same as. I mean, look at what, like, with Lego. Lego had to actually do a lot more with their figures to appeal to the girl market, because for a long time Lego just simply said, "Girls are going to play with Barbie, and we're not going to bother." Yeah, and they said, "Okay, let's actually make Lego for girls," but it was quite different. You know, it's a lot more sort of anthropomorphic, you know.
And then suddenly they realized, "Wow, we can sell our models to like." Double the amount of people.
That's right, yeah. And they did so quite successfully as well. So, I mean, I'd be interested to see if GW can make the same thing happen. I don't know whether wargaming will ever sort of really, you know, achieve
attract
that.
Females?
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't want to sound misogynistic. There are plenty of girls that I know that play Warhammer as well.
Yeah.
But it's certainly, it's a very...
Male-dominated.
You go to any sort of convention for it, and it's, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, people said the same thing about computer games for a long time, but now Xbox, PlayStation, they've all penetrated the female market quite well. And there's the option that Games Workshop could do that here with the new edition if they're sensible. And I think it's a perfect time to do it. And you can do it with a canon excuse as well.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. Oh, we'll see. That's interesting speculation. I don't know.
That is pure speculation on my part, though. When they announced a new, better space marine, I thought, oh, yeah. Well, let's see where this goes.
You should make a YouTube channel or YouTube video just about your speculation. I bet you'll get as many dislikes as you got likes.
Yeah. I could do stuff like the Minotaurs are actually Iron Warriors and stuff like that. Black Templars are actually World Eaters.
Yeah,
you could do all sorts of things. You'd make a lot of people very angry.
That's it. So that's one thing they've got, the canon. I've seen also the map has changed.
The map has changed drastically with a huge tear across the galaxy.
Yeah.
That changes everything. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
We'll also see how the time dilation thing goes. We know for a fact they've announced there will be at least two more Primarchs returning.
Yes.
Plus there will be one faction change for a Primarch. So one Primarch is either going to turn traitor, or a traitor is going to turn loyalist, or someone like Alpharon Omegron, or whatever the hell you want to call him, the Primarch of the Alpha Legion, is going to finally declare for a side.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start with that. So Let's start with the easy one. The Primarch to change sides. Who would you speculate that could be?
Primarch of the Alpha Legion is the easy one.
Yep.
I mean, he comes out and he says, actually, I've been for the Emperor all along.
Yeah.
And they could get away with that quite easily. Yeah. That's the easy path.
Yeah.
You could have one of the loyalists fall to chaos.
Yeah.
Someone like Jagati Khan, who's been lost in the webway for millennia. You could also have someone turn loyalist, like Fulgrim, Primarch of the Emperor's Children.
Yeah, it was always sort of... Yeah.
Well, he was possessed by a demon. He technically...
Never fell. I mean,
never fell, but then they changed canon, so he did, and now they might change canon back, so he never actually...
Yeah, Magnus the Red, you know, there was benevolence behind his decision to...
Well, yeah, but I think with his release recently as a Demon Prince model, he's not going to change that.
So, I don't know who it might be, but my speculation is it will be a traitor legion turning back to loyalist. Now, the reason that I predict that, now, we've always had a balance in the setting in that there's as many traitor legions from the original 20 as there are loyalist legions and such. There's always been the, I think it's what, eight and eight or something, and there's the other four are the ones that have been removed. But there's a lot of people are speculating now that we're going to see a cataclysm for the Blood Angels. Lots of the sort of stories hitting out.
Yeah, well, they're on the wrong side of the tear for a start.
That's it, yeah. They're going to be screwed, so we may actually see a major change. I mean, and the Blood Angels are a well-loved chapter that they could be...
I think I've mentioned to you previously off the show that I think, personally, Sanguinus will return.
Yeah, it's a good answer. They're one of the ones to come back, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. That's my personal opinion. He may have been killed, but death isn't necessarily the end, not even for a Primarch.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just saying, I could see them bringing a traitor chapter back to balance getting rid of a loyalist chapter.
Yeah, but getting rid of the Blood Angels is a big, ballsy move.
Yeah, it's not the Raven Guard or the Iron Warriors, that sort of stuff. No,
they're a major faction which have had their own book releases, they've got their own model lines. That's a huge move to kill them off.
Yeah.
But you could certainly weaken them. I mean, you could do a Crimson Fist to him and have him wiped out to a single company type thing.
So who could you see coming back as far as Primarchs go? So you think Sanguinius is probably one of them?
Sanguinius, yeah, I think that's a possibility.
Yep.
It's a long shot, but I think it's there. Lehman Russ is possible.
Yeah.
And probably most likely, I would say Lionel Johnson.
Okay, so you think you're going for the bigger ones, like, you know, like for example, for the Salamanders, Primarch, who's technically can't die.
Well, he's still around. Yeah, I mean, he is still around. You could have, he's certainly another possibility. I mean, I think I'll go for one of the big ones as the next one back.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
So it's Robert Gilliman was not big enough, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, going forward with the Chaos Gods, we saw in Age of Sigmar, they dropped Slaanesh. Slaanesh still exists, but Slaanesh got crippled and weakened, and, you know, King Rat took over, so Skaven took over.
Yeah, and exactly what you said, it was more of a technological focused god, such in terms of what the...
Yeah, and I see that actually for 40k as well. I think the Eldar are going to finally kill Slaanesh, or at least cripple Slaanesh so strongly that he gets weakened, and we'll see a new god rise, and I think a technological god again. They've talked about the Forge Master in previous canon stuff with the book settings.
Yeah.
You know, all those stomping demon war machines that are, you know, possessed machines, they make a deal with someone called the Forge Master, who they sell their eternal loyalty to, even above the god that created them. And he gives them a robotic body that they can take into the real world and stomp things with.
Because I could actually see, that also with the Eldar, like, we've seen the Eldar sort of at the end of their civilization now. They're not going to remove the Eldar altogether, but I think they're going to fundamentally change the Eldar. And we've already seen Craftworlds destroyed. We've seen them trying to raise a new Eldar god. I could see them bringing that Eldar god into the game the same way that you have Cain, Avatars of Cain.
You've got Ynead, or Avatar of Ynead, you can play now in the setting.
That's it. And that I think that they'll become a much more sort of less Craftworld based, more nomadic as such, more small group, almost like, you know, more akin to how the Dark Eldar are. I think that's how we're going to see the Eldar progress
over time. Yeah. I tend to agree with that, and I think that a new technological god, and you could also bring Perturbo,
yeah,
Primarch of the Iron Warriors, as his new champion.
Yeah.
I think you could definitely go that path.
Okay, so what about system then? We spoke about the setting. What are they? What are we looking at changing with the system?
So, in basic terms, yeah, movement stat is back. Every model has its own movement stat.
Initiative
is gone. Yeah. That's the most fundamental change from stat lines. Otherwise, yeah, it looks pretty much the same. Lots of things have got more wounds now. So, for example, a Terminator has 2 wounds, but only less move. Yeah. Than a normal Marine. Strength and toughness are now no longer limited at 10. They can go up and up.
Yeah, vehicles go for a standard stat block now.
They have a standard stat line now and saving throw, so your Dreadnoughts now with, you know, 20 wounds, 10 wounds, whatever it is, stomping around, but some weapons do more than one wound.
Yeah.
So we're going back towards what it was in 2nd edition with multiple wounds on weapons, but models tend to have more wounds. So, you know, in the old edition, a Carnifex had... 2nd edition, Carnifex had 10 wounds, 10 toughness,
yeah,
and, you know, a good crack missile hit still wouldn't kill it outright because it only did D10 wounds, but there was a chance.
Yeah.
And I see that as, you know, a good thing.
It may be the FFG player in me, but my first thought when I hear about the sort of increased wounds, increased weapon damage thing is it sounds like a good excuse to sell wound tokens.
Yes.
Because, well, that's one of the hardest things about having the model wounds is tracking who's wounded on the board.
Whose wounds are on the board, which, yep, leads to the next thing of one thing which has gone: templates. They'll, yep, no longer be flamer templates or blast templates. All gone.
Yeah.
So they hit a certain number of people. Done.
Yeah. So you basically fire into a group as such, into a squad, and you roll. So you can't just try and mix your template across people from two different squads that happen to be close together.
Yeah. I mean, you've played. Everyone who's played knows the horror that is. You shoot something, it lands, you roll the scatter dice, and no one can ever agree on what direction the scatter dice is actually showing. Yeah. Everyone always has a slightly different interpretation, which, surprise, surprise, helps them just a little more.
Parallax error is, yes, the line, that's it. Yeah,
yeah. And
I see the formations are out now as well, so that's a lot of people are happy with the removal of formations.
Yeah, because they started... Later on into 7th edition, they had more and more formations where having a certain formation gave you certain abilities, and some of them just got ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, and with that gone, that's good. The new system for building an army looks better. Gives, yeah, you something called command points that they haven't told us what you can do with them. They've just said you can do fancy things with them. So movement phase now contains also running. So whereas before you'd have to run in the shooting phase, it's now all done in one phase.
Yeah.
So speeds and streamlines it a bit there. Shooting and weapon skill, ballistic skill now are basic to hit of 2+, 3+, 4+, whatever. So there's no charts or tables or comparing weapon skill of one versus the other. No more of that. Whoever charges in close combat goes first. Yeah. I think rules-wise, everything they've announced so far streamlines the game.
Yeah. I think that, what's interesting about it is the whole path to market. The fact that everything's going to be free. The rules will be free. I don't know about codexes as such, but I think that you can at least get enough to build the army for free.
Yeah, they've announced already that any model that exists in the game at the moment that has rules will have rules on release date.
Okay.
So even your craziest Forge World beastie will have a set of rules for it, and it will be there.
Yeah.
Codexes will come out along the way with new and expanded rules, new expanded units, all that sort of thing. But I think streamlining is good.
Yeah.
And like you said, I mean, all the rules free, so
yeah,
it's not going to cost people anything.
Just buy minis, you know. And if you've got a prodigious collection of miniatures like you or I do,
yeah,
it's actually quite welcoming to...
Yeah, because I'll be able to play any of my armies just... for free. I won't have to go out and buy set codexes and go, oh, this unit type has changed, now all of a sudden I need to replace these models with these models to be able to use it.
Because you and I both anal have to say that, you know, if the model has a plasma gun, the figure's got a plasma gun, you know, it's
like, yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes. I mean, it's definitely going to be a step forward in the right direction.
Yeah. I think that overall, you know, if you have gotten out of the war game, or even if you've never played the war game, if you're just a player of the role-playing game or whatever, it's a good time to get back or get into it, because I think that 8th edition is going to bring a lot of players either back to the game or a lot of new players in.
Yeah.
So it's a good opportunity to go to your local GW store and have a bang. And the good thing is, well, if you get back into it, that you're going to have all these resources like miniatures and scenery and that sort of stuff that you can still use in the RPG.
Yeah.
We've spoken at length in the past about doing miniature stuff in the RPG, and it will get your friends keen about playing the RPGs again, to be honest.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
I'm playing, I mentioned before, running Mutant Chronicles for our group, and two of my players said, you know, playing Mutant Chronicles makes me want to play Dark Heresy even more, you know, so...
Yeah.
It's something you can come back to after a while as well, so I think that this is good for GW, and it's good for the hobby overall. And yeah, I think that, you know, success of the new edition will contribute towards the desire for GW and their partners to
release
and update the role-playing game as well.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've covered that enough. Shall we move on to the rest of the show? Okay,
yep,
let's keep going.
Oh, the only thing I'll say in addition is, if you're not already, join the Warhammer 40K Facebook page, their official page.
Yep.
They're releasing new information every single day up until release. And they'll be releasing stuff after release. Take a look at it. Read their stuff. They're giving away the rules already, pretty much.
Okay, we'll put a link on the website in the show notes anyway.
Yeah,
so.
Definitely.
Okay, great. Let's keep going. All supplicants report to the administratum for career assignment. Okay, let's actually start talking about some Rogue Trader stuff, since this is a Rogue Trader episode. And as this is the career discussion section, we're now going to talk about ships. We're back around to transports again.
Yeah,
we've done cruise last time, so now we're talking about the Vagabond class merchant trader, which is of course from the core book as well. So the role of the Vagabond, it's generally considered the standard generic bulk transport ship, you know, also very good as a passenger ship as well.
The completely uninteresting Vagabond.
Yeah.
Ships are, every ship is unique.
Yeah.
But if there was a ship which probably...
The least unique?
Least unique, it's the Vagabond.
Yeah. I mean, this particular hull is very popular among Chartist captains.
Yep.
Particularly in the Calixtus sector, you know, which is sort of connected to Chronos Expanse, which is where the game is set. So I guess if you're looking for prestige, you know, for something that stands out, this is not it. If you want something that is covert, you know, something that is easily overlooked, then this is potentially the ship for you. Also, it's relatively versatile in defense.
Yeah.
So unlike the, what was the other transport that's in there we covered previously? Let's look it up. Anyway, what this one does have among transports is it's got the dorsal slot. So dorsal and prow.
Yep.
Which does mean you can do your standard lance plus macro battery combination, which is relatively effective in combat.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, putting a lance
on a transport
is a bit odd.
But you can.
Certainly nothing to stop you.
Let me rephrase that. Generically, standard transport used by a Chartist captain to move goods around the sector, you wouldn't put a lance on it. A transport used by a Rogue Trader to explore the Chronos Expanse, there is more sort of reason to have the sort of lance macro battery combination there.
Yeah, yeah. So the Jericho is the other
transport. That's right, yeah.
The Jericho Pilgrim, which is a prow port starboard.
Yeah.
And this one is...
A dorsal prow.
Dorsal prow. So you've got the advantage that you can have two shots to the front.
Yeah.
Or one to each side.
Generally speaking, you only get the benefit of having the port and starboard if you're able to bring... If there's two ships to bring your weapons to bear on, it's pretty hard to get port and starboard onto the same target.
Yeah.
And if you're going to transport, you're fighting two ships, you're pretty much screwed anyway.
Yeah.
So I'd rather have the versatility of a dorsal weapon.
Plus, there's also the size bonus effects as well, because having a weapon in your port and your starboard takes up more space than just having the same weapon once on the dorsal.
That's true.
Which is good because it has less space than a Pilgrim.
Yeah, but not by much. But I mean, that seems to work, but it loses out predominantly. So it's faster, it's got a speed of 4, detection of plus 10, armor is higher at 13 as well, the space is a bit lower, maneuverability is better at minus 5, 40 hull integrity is where it really loses out. It's a lower hull integrity overall. Turret rating of 1, but it is 20 ship points.
It's the same ship points as the Pilgrim.
Yeah.
But I think, personally, it's actually a better choice.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, like, if I was choosing a transport, the one I'd probably go for would be the Loki-class Q-ship.
Yes, the Q... I think personally,
It's one more point. Its stats are exactly the same as the Vagabond, but it's one more ship point, and you get 5 more space. And I think that otherwise the stats are identical. And the fact that you are locked to the wolf in sheep's clothing past history as such. So,
which is fine. I think the Q ship's a better choice.
Yeah, which we'll cover in a future episode as well.
But
so certainly this one is, I mean, 4 speed is pretty much the fastest transport you get, except for the Star Clipper, obviously, with a speed of 10.
Yeah.
Personally,
I'd go for the Star Clipper as my transport choice. The Q ship is good, but the Star Clipper is much better because it's so much faster.
You're not going to be outrunning, you're not going to be winning stern chases in a transport, generally speaking. No. So, I mean, I just think the fact that it's got, you know, the better maneuverability, the better detection, makes it a more versatile ship overall. Yeah. Than you get with the Jericho. It's got the same special trait, the cargo hauler trait, which means that it comes with a main cargo hold already installed. That's already accounted for in the space, but you do have to supply 2 power.
And you can never get rid of that.
Never get rid of that, exactly right, yeah. When it comes to useful components for this ship, I mean, as I already mentioned, that for a rogue trader, you may want to consider a lance. So you've got your basic combat tactic there of use macro batteries to get rid of the void shields, and then get a heavy damaging lance strike, which ignores armor, basically. So.
Which for a transport isn't a bad idea, mainly because, you know, you might be able to cripple them with one shot, or more likely, scare them off.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Exactly. Get a critical, start a fire, run away.
Yeah.
Only deal with that. I mean, looking at the main detriment to this ship being its hull integrity, you may want to consider reinforced interior bulkheads just to boost that a bit. Another one I thought was potentially, if you want to go for the sort of the smuggler concept, maybe think about shadow blind bays.
Yeah.
So they give you the versatility of going for either trade or criminal objectives with your cargo bays as well. So
plus the descriptive thing in game of the fact that they're shielded and
hidden. you can't scan them, like they're designed to sort of, you know, push off all specs and that sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, once again, you're going for the rule of cool here over the rule of stats.
Yeah.
If you were to get into combat with the Vagabond, which probably isn't your first choice, and once again, you've got that lance macro battery combination, but I would say that your best combat option with a transport in general is to take friends. don't be the only ship out there. You know,
there's that, or turn everything off and drift.
Yeah.
And hope that they can't find you.
That's it. Yeah, I mean, once again, I mean, the space combat's happening in 40k, but huge distances, you know, looking for something is never going to see it as such. So.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to outrun much in the Vagabond unless they're in an even slower ship, which not many exist. And you're not really going to fight off much. You could probably fight off a raider.
Yeah.
But you're not going to outrun a raider. Just be careful.
Alright. So, Mike, you're playing a new Rogue Trader game. You've only got the core book. You've got minimal ship points. The crew's decided to go for a transport. You've got the Jericho or the Vagabond. So, you know, Vagabond, faster, a bit more versatile, less hull integrity, though, by 10. It's like 20% less.
Yeah.
But
it's got 5 more manoeuvrability, 5 more detection, which also helps.
Yeah, 1 less gun.
But it doesn't really matter because I'm never going to use both Prowl and Starboard.
Out of those 2 options, you choose the Vagabond?
Yeah, I would.
I agree with that. I'd definitely choose the Vagabond if I was going to. Out of the 2?
Vagabond.
Yeah. So, and I guess it comes down to if you're playing a long-term Rogue Trader game and you get to the point where eventually you can actually have a second ship, you might be able to afford to acquire a second ship, I would say that a transport is a good second ship to have. Especially if your first ship can protect, your transport as such, as a larger cruiser or frigate, for example. I would say that it's a good option to take a cruiser, take a transport as a secondary ship.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, the spacing, it all comes back to, like I said, with the weapons thing.
Yeah.
The smallest gun is 2 space.
Yeah.
So
you got 40 space on the Vagabond to play with, so
yeah. I mean, the Jericho class, if you put a gun in every slot,
yeah,
you've spent 4 points for port and starboard, whereas on the Jericho...
On the prow.
Sorry, on... Yeah, and 2 on this, you've spent 6. And with the Vagabond, if you fill both slots with the same thing, you spent 4.
And you've got, yeah, effectively... essentially... You can be the same fire to bear on a single ship.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. And it's a difference of 3 space. So that 5 extra space is a little deceptive. It's actually 3. I suppose the only real difference is if you decided for some reason to take something like escort fighter bays, which have to go in a port or a starboard slot, you'd have to choose.
Yeah, although you can take, isn't there the modified, in one of the books there's the modified
hold.
The fighter hold, whatever it is, which has penalties because it's not designed for it as such. But
essentially they cut a slot in your main cargo hold so you can use it as a fighter bay,
exactly.
You could do that.
Yeah.
If you wanted to if you wanted to retrofit this thing into a very, very
tiny carrier,
very cheap warship.
Yeah.
The thing is, you've got to remember, if you turn up to some primitive backwater planet and you have fighters and bombers, and they've got sticks and stones, you're going to win.
Yeah.
You know. So this thing could take over a planet if it was a particularly poor planet.
Yeah.
If it's the right planet.
Yeah.
Just have to pick the right planet.
Yeah, that's it. Because there's no poor starship in 40K. You know, they're all incredibly ancient pieces of technology and incredibly valuable. Even the small ones.
Yeah, fill those space up with some some barracks.
Yeah.
Munitorium. Fill the hold with guns. Go out there and conquer. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, this is the sort of ship that the Imperium would use to transport a guard detachment.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
That's it. It's not expected to fight on the way there.
It's just expected to get there.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Load them up with troops and food and off they go. So.
Yeah.
Alright then, so there's another option for you. Let's keep going.
Okay.
Attention, loyal servants of the Imperium. Stand by to receive orders.
Okay, so on to plot hooks, and I hadn't written this one up as a description. This is more what I want to discuss. So, I've seen this happen a few times in movies and shows, both sci-fi and otherwise, where you've got a ship which is a focal point of your story. Okay, so let's take the example of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Okay.
So you've got the Black Pearl. You know, let's look at in the Expanse. You've got the Rosinante. You know, you've got parts where the ship is as much a character as the other characters are as well. And for whatever reason, at some point, you end up on the wrong side of a ship switch. You know, somebody boards your ship and steals it, but you're able to get away in theirs. Or, you're left behind somewhere and you have to go and recover your ship. And so, suddenly you've got a situation where you've still got access to a ship. You know, you've still got, you might have the enemy ship, you might have a smaller ship, whatever, and you're now working to try and recover, what was originally yours, what's been stolen and such. I know that you, Mike, in general, you don't like games where the GM takes away your stuff.
No, it's not that. It's the big problem with the boarding action version of this story is the crew's 18,000 people at least.
Yeah.
Do all 18,000 people switch sides?
Well, I mean, I think it's okay. So first off, I can imagine that with Imperium ship crews, a lot of them don't know who the captain is. They don't even care. You know, they get their orders from, their deck chief, whatever the case may be, their section leader.
Yeah, and if they all get killed and replaced with someone who actually knows what they're doing,
At the end of the day, this ship is their home. If somebody's taken over the bridge, 50 decks up, and is issuing different orders, they don't care as long as they get to stay in their home. And do what they've always done and survive and such. They don't want to. And that being said, I'm not necessarily suggesting this is part of just a dice roll of a boarding action. I mean, more it would be, for my mind, this would be more of a thing in a campaign where
someone steals your ship while it's in dock.
Yeah, or you're invited on board another ship and somehow betrayed as such. It's all done under a sort of a covert banner as such, and you've now got to recover your ship. I mean, you and I both run campaigns where you start off with a ship which is not the intended
final ship.
And then you've got to, and it's getting the replacement ship or getting your own ship is as much a part of the story. And the reason I wanted to mix this plot hook section with the war gear section is that if you go through the books, what we've got stats on is Xenos ships. We've got Eldar ships, we've got Orc ships, we've got Chaos ships, Do you think it will be possible for a human crew to take over a Xenos ship?
Depends on the ship. Depends on the race.
Yeah.
So, Orc ships, no. Yeah. Because it's the belief of the Orc that this ship flies that makes it fly.
Yeah, that's right. It's the whole thing that where Orcs are latently psychics and their gear only works because they believe it does.
Yes. So, possibly you could get it to work for a while that belief still holds even after the death of the Orcs.
Yeah.
But you're going to be losing a lot of crew along the way.
So everything common becomes unreliable.
Yes.
Yeah, everything unreliable becomes non-functional.
Yes. Suddenly you're venting crewmen as, along with the oxygen into space. It could kind of work.
Yeah.
Eldar, I just don't see humans having the technological grasp on how the ship works to make the ship work.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's sort of... When it comes to players of Rogue Trader wanting to get their hands on Xenotech, the most interesting always seems to be Eldar, you know, because Eldar look human. They have this sort of classic, you know, fantasy elf grace that, you know, appeals to some players as such. And so, I mean, I've had a character which has had Eldar equipment on their, you know, on their equipment list as well as an affectation or, you know, Xenotech and such. But I think that an Eldar ship, given the way Infinity Circuits work, and because you've only got an Infinity Circuit in a craft world, but you can assume that the...
They have spirit stones in their helm and things.
The ship's made of Wraithbone, which has
it's Eldar psychically spirit. Attuned.
Yeah, that's it. It's
not the sort of thing that you can just sort of jump in and speed off in. You need to actually be able to control it and commune with the spirits of the dead that control a lot of the systems.
Yeah.
And I very much doubt they're going to be willing to help a human.
Yeah.
Unless...
Chaos ships?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, chaos ships are... They're just human ships. Yeah. The more the risk is what you're interacting with, the ship itself will be in some way inherently corrupted. You know,
I suppose the big problem is you have to make sure that the Gellerfield actually works. Because if you've taken over a ship controlled by someone who's crazy enough, they may well have disabled their Gellerfield. Parts of the ship might be actually possessed.
Yeah.
But
that being said, I mean, if you take something like an Iconoclast, you know, like a pirate ship as such, which has a human crew of Chaos Worshippers, going through the warp without a Gellerfield is still very bad for them.
Oh.
You know, Khorne doesn't care from where the skulls come. You know, so.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, to be honest, personally, I like some of the Chaos ships, the designs of them and what they've actually got on them more than some of the Imperial ships.
Yeah.
From my days of playing Battlefleet Gothic,
some
of the Chaos ships are actually better ships. The Styx and the Hades stand out more so than any others.
Really? See, mankind should have known back then, when they created these ships and gave them names based upon evil things, they were going to fall to evil. I don't know, you know. It just seems like convenience that you just happen to have these, you know.
Okay, what are we going to call this new class of ship? The Lucifer.
It is a prize when suddenly, you know. It's like, you know, the forces of chaos aren't going to take over a ship which is, you know, named something like the Benevolence, you know.
Yeah. Well, we're calling it the Skull Taker class. What could possibly go wrong?
But you're right, I think the chaos ships are probably the easiest one. Especially because a lot of chaos ships have slave holds. Yes. So, yeah, you can release...
They come with crew built in.
That's right, yeah, who aren't necessarily worshippers of chaos, you know. So, at least in the short term, they might be suitable. I think that, I mean, there's no real stats for them, but Tau ships, I mean, Tau are a race which integrate other races.
Yeah.
So if they're going to have a technology which is more than likely adaptable, I'd say
Tau would probably fit.
Krut,
mercenary ships,
and their technology is
built by someone else,
taken from others as such, a combination thereof.
Krut ships would fit.
They probably smell a lot, you know. But
Tyranid ships, absolutely not. Have a lot of trouble with a Tyranid ship.
By entering a Tyranid ship, you've effectively been eaten in the first place. So
I suppose. Space marine ships now. I think yes. I don't know how you'd ever manage to get hold of one, but you could, because, I mean, the crew of the ship aren't actually Marines. There isn't a Marine sitting in the pilot's chair of...
It depends on what canon you read. So for example, one of the audiobooks I listened to, I can't remember which one it was, but it included a Marine who had been crippled in battle. And in order to keep the Marine alive, the only sort of life support system they had was the command chair of the ship. So they sort of widened the command chair of the ship on the basis that later on he would be transferred to a dreadnought. But it just, one thing...
It just never happened.
It just never happened. And so you've got this venerable Marine who is effectively, like, you know, from the torso down, a starship.
But, so for some reason I just started thinking of a centaur.
That's right, he's on the prow.
Prow of the ship!
No, it's like a figurehead. No, he's in the command chair as such. But I mean, so some canon says that, you have full human crews. Some say that Marine ship crews are all servitors.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, you look at the Ultramarine ship in the Ultramarines movie, pretty much there's a squad of Marines on board, and then just servitors. And that's it, there is no... functional crew.
I find that probably the least likely version of events, just because of the fact that servitors, they're dumb.
Yeah, they can't.
And they're not very good at anything unless they're told to do it.
They don't have a third eye, they can't navigate the warp.
You know, yeah, like. I mean, that's it, navigation as well. Any of these systems you have.
Communication requires psychers, so.
Yeah, you have to have psychers and people who you need to bring with you from your ship.
Yeah, I mean, even with the servitor crew add-on for a ship in Rogue Trader, I still think that there would be an amount, probably a few thousand living crew.
There still has to be some living crew.
Yeah.
Even if you place everything with servitors, there's some jobs that cannot be done by things which are servitors. For one thing, the tech priest.
Yes.
Because, you know what, all those servitors, they still have to be fixed and repaired and rebuilt.
Machines, moving machines, help of us.
Can't do that. That's obscene.
Anyway, so there's just some thought about it. I mean, you might want to create the unusual environment of having to co-opt an alien ship. I mean, and once again, in Rogue Trader, create your own aliens. Create your own aliens who have technology that can be... I mean, the what are those creatures called in Rogue Trader that are like the dogmen with...
Strix.
Strixes, yeah. I imagine they're ships because they, once again, cobble together other people's hardware. Will be one that you could potentially take over, so...
Yeah.
Yep. It's another thing to do. The old switcheroo, so...
The old switcheroo, yeah.
All right, let's get going.
My lord, the information you requested is now available for your review.
So let's get into our review. Now, Mike, were you a Dawn of War player in the first place? Did you play any of the Dawn of War games?
I played the first Dawn of War.
Yeah.
And I started trying to play the second Dawn of War, but I just didn't find it as good.
Okay.
So I just didn't get into it.
All right. So, and when you say the first, did you play all the expansions or just the original?
The original and I think the first expansion.
Okay. Winter Assault. Yeah. So, Dawn of War, I mean, if you're not familiar with it, if you've been under a rock, Dawn of War is a 40k gaming series that uses the real-time strategy sort of setup that was... I think, what was the first real-time strategy game I can think of was Dune 2. Would that be alright? I mean, obviously, Warcraft made it famous and such. You know,
Dune 2.
I reckon Dune 2 is probably the first.
Then Command and Conquer.
Yeah. That's sort of the first RTS I can remember anyway, but I mean...
Back in the day.
Yeah, and Dawn of War 1... I really enjoyed and played a lot of. Played all the expansions because it had what I liked in RTS games. It had base building mechanics. It ran on the fact that your resource acquisition was not built upon harvesting, but upon point control. So, you know, you control a point and your resource just naturally grew. You didn't have harvesting, you had to go out and send...
You didn't have to worry whenever you heard the word worm sign.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Tidarian Harvest under attack, all that sort of stuff, you know, so... So it had those things I quite like. It had a robust tech tree, which grew as you added more games, and you had lots of
and it wasn't over the top either, tech tree, yeah.
You had different races, but by the time Soulstorm came out for the 1-1, you had Marines, Chaos, Eldar, Orcs, Tau, Dark Eldar...
Imperial Guard...
Sisters of Battle. So, you know, eight different options
factions,
you could choose from straight away there. And that was really good. We played a lot of Dawn of War 1 multiplayer.
Yeah.
So what we'd usually do is we'd get all of us... So when I say all of us, this is a group of myself and two other friends. We'd play on one team. So it's three humans. And we'd have four of the hardest difficulty level computer teams working as, against us, so not as one team as such, so they were one team, and then we'd try and survive and conquer the map, basically. And that would be good. You'd like a sort of 4 or 5 hour game there, and it was really a case of you had to build defences right away because the computer would just throw itself at you straight away. Yeah. And it was always go, 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 you know. Well, we really liked that. Dawn of War 2 was a different story, because Dawn of War 2 was... So the company which made Dawn of War 1 also made a game called Company of Heroes, which was a World War 2 style RTS. And it had a lot less on the base building side. It was more about unit tactics. And Dawn of War 2 had next to no base building.
Yeah.
It was really just unit tactics, especially in the campaign. You had whole missions where you didn't build a single building. And I really struggled to get into Dawn of War 2. In fact, I bought the expansion pack. I've never even installed the expansion pack, I don't think, because it's just the first game.
Yeah, I was the same. I think it was a lot of micro as well. It was like telling guys when to throw their grenades.
Yeah, that
sort of thing, which I always found odd in RTSs. I can't ever imagine Patton going, quick, get squad 13 to throw their grenades now.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's my... I remember another friend of ours used to say that, you know, RTSs aren't a real show of how warfare works, because it wasn't like Patton just harvested a million resources, built 10,000 Sherman tanks and zerged Rommel's position.
Yeah.
But, they still have mechanics that work as such, yeah, as far as games go. Okay, so on to Dawn of War 3. So, still Relic Entertainment, so still the same company along down the track, which is done, still part of, you know, published by Sega, so it's the same pedigree of game, basically. And they have moved back towards the base building mechanic.
Yeah.
Personally, my opinion is they haven't moved back far enough. So, you've got... I mean, I don't remember much about the buildings in Dawn of War 1, but you've got your stronghold, you've got your barracks, you've got your armory for doing tech research, you've got your machine cult for doing your vehicles, you've got listening posts you build on capture points, and that's it. So they've gotten rid of any of the power-generating facilities, for example. Strategic points now generate both power and strategic resource. They've gotten rid of like the relic building. They've gotten rid of static defences, so no turrets.
Really, no turrets?
Yeah, that's it.
What about walls?
No walls. No, well, there was no walls in Dawn of War 1 anyway. I mean, walls was really a sort of a Dune thing.
Dune thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, because you had to also build concrete slabs just to put buildings down in the first place. Yeah,
that was annoying.
Yeah.
Oh no, we forgot to build foundations on our building. Who the hell does this? Oh, you contractors.
Subcontractors. but anyway, so it has got a tech tree, but it's not as robust either. So pretty much you've got attack and defence upgrades from infantry, attack and defence upgrades for vehicles, each one has 3 levels, and I think there's like one like power weapons upgrade as well, sort of thing, you know. And that's really it as far as the tech tree goes.
Okay, so it's not much tech tree either.
No, that's it, yeah. So, and it does still have a very heavy focus on unit tactics. So it does still have grenades, you know, on individual units. You have to select that unit and hit use a grenade and then click on the field.
If I send a squad of Marines to fight against a tank, they should know to use their grenades on their own.
Yeah, a lot of RTSs actually have a mode with a lot of units where you can basically just like shift click on an ability, and the unit will just use that ability when it's ready each time as such, you know.
They should just know when to use it when it's actually suitable. You don't use crack grenades against Gretchen, but, you know, if you're fighting against a Dreadnought, you shouldn't have to tell them, oh, use your melter bombs, or...
And I think the game is a bit micromanaging, because you do have to have... If I've got a big group where I've got a couple of heroes and I've got a bunch of units, and, you know... Only one of the heroes' action bar is going to show, so I have to click through my other units in order to find the one I want to use, click on the ability, click on the battlefield I want to use it as such.
Yeah, that was always the problem with the whole micro thing, is you can't send a diversionary force and then come around the back, because unless you're micromanaging your diversionary force, they get wiped out too quickly.
Well, that's it. I mean, the computer has no problem micromanaging it, because it has... You know,
the computer doesn't! The players do, and that was always the issue.
Yeah. So, look, I haven't played much of the campaign so far. I've been playing a lot of the multiplayer with friends through the same thing. We've been, you know, a group of us against a group of computers. The multiplayer mode in this, it only has one multiplayer mode right now, and they say they are going to update it, but right now it's a sort of MOBA-style thing where you've got to first destroy a generator, then destroy a turret, and then destroy the base building as such. That's the order, and the pretty much the other buildings are invulnerable, or like when the generator's still up, the turret does so much damage you can't even get near it, basically, you know. And,
okay.
The turret's right by the base, so you can't get to the base without destroying the turret first, so... it sort of works that way, but it's a stepped sort of progress or such. Now, I have a relatively decent gaming rig, I gotta say. I mean, my machine now, it's over 2 years old now, but it's still an i7. I've got a GTX 970 card, which is still decent. This game I struggle with. It crashes a lot. I mean, I played it last night. It took me 5 loads of the game to actually get into a mission. And it will generally crash when it's loading a mission. I haven't had a crash mid-mission, but it has crashed several times loading a mission. I've had to drop my settings down to medium to have a reliableness of getting into it as such, so it really is taxing on...
You're not suggesting that a computer game company would release a half-finished product. I can't believe that computer game companies would do such a thing.
No, I mean, it's polished. The product is polished as such. I'm not seeing bugs.
Yeah.
I'm just seeing that they've really... pushed. They haven't optimized. That's what they haven't. They haven't optimized the system to, you know, to be able to be used on multiple different sort of platforms and such. Because I can run other stuff like I can run the most recent Call of Duty game on ultra settings without dropping below, you know, sort of the 50 frame per second mark. So
yeah.
To have a game like you have a real time strategy game, and look, it's just because they've got lots of flashy effects, lots of particle effects. Yeah. You know, lots of abilities have knockback, so you know you're really, and suddenly like 50 troops go flying through the air because everyone
they've got to work out all the physics and every time anything happens.
That's it. Yeah. So to be honest, what playing Dawn of War 3 has done has made me play Dawn of War 1 again, and the group of us that were playing are actually now playing Dawn of War 1 more often than not, and I'm really just playing through Dawn of War 3 for the purposes of the campaign.
Yeah.
Now I like the campaign. The campaign is good. What they've done here is. So you remember back in Warcraft, okay? So in Warcraft you would play, or actually, better would be Starcraft.
Yeah.
You played the Terran campaign, then you played the Protoss campaign, or the Zerg campaign. You did the three campaigns one after the other, and you got to play all the races as part of the campaign. Whereas in like Dawn of War 1, the campaign was Space Marines. Yeah. The game came with Chaos, and it came with Orcs, but you played Space Marines. The way that Dawn of War 3 works is that you're playing all three. The missions alternate between you doing the Marines, you doing the Orcs, you doing the Eldar. I've yet to come across a point in the game where I've played the same race in two consecutive missions.
Okay.
And given that the races are quite different in their mechanic...
makes a bit of a disconnect.
It can be hard to sort of really work out how to optimise, you know. And you actually have... You get strategic points for your accomplishments, and you have your heroes level up. And you've got this whole... Rather than the building tech tree in game, the campaign has this sort of... tech tree of abilities that you can buy and then equip on your troops outside of the missions.
Yep.
But you get your points at the end of the mission. You go and spend your advances to get new abilities. But then it's two more missions again before you get to play that race again. So it does feel like you do get that bit of disconnect as such.
Yeah.
I like the fact they got Imperial Knights in there into the game. Like one of the other players I play with who's a 40k semi-fan was like, oh, they've got Titans. I'm like, they're not Titans. They're not technically part of the Titanic Ecclesia. You know, they're technically...
They're not. Imperial Knight households.
You know, but they look like Titans. They're as big as Titans. No, they're not. They're about half the size of Titans. Had to go and explain it all, you know. But an Imperial Knight, anyway. It's one of the sort of... The human heroes, basically.
So... Which chapter are they using? Is it Blood Ravens again?
Blood Ravens again. That's it.
And is the voice acting better than previous?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's typical Games Workshop, you know, I'm gonna say everything like I'm shouting.
Yeah.
And that makes me sound like I'm a space marine.
Yeah, that's okay. But does it at least sound like he knows how to pronounce the word space marine?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Games Workshop has a rule. They only use British voice actors, you know, so... Yeah. Because yeah, it's a British game, so of course all space.
Yeah, that's fine, but yeah. You've heard the terrible voice acting in
Yeah, and the reason for that is because the from what I understand, I don't know, this is what I've heard, is that in the original Dawn of War, all of the like the major characters, like, you know, so your captain, your librarian, etc., they were all professional voice actors. All of the incidental noise that the troops make is just like the, their friends around the office got called in for a, you know, for a voice recording day. So.
Okay. That explains a lot.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the case, but that's what I heard anyway. So, yeah. You know, but I like the fact that they've progressed the storyline to a point now where it's new characters, but there's callbacks to the old ones. So, for example, one of the Eldar heroes is a what are their sort of really big Wraith Knights called?
Wraith Lord.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
The Wraith Lord, which is a special character, is named Wraith Lord Tal'Dyr, whereas Farseer Tal'Dyr was one of the Farseers in the earlier Dawn of War game. So presumably, she's later died and been interred into a Wraith Lord or such, and
is the dominant. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I did like that, and visually, it's very pretty. You know, even on medium settings at the moment, which I'm playing on. It's still very pretty, I would say. Like the particle effects, the lighting, the explosions, the audio is great, and I like the fact that the map grows as the mission does. So rather than you get into the mission and you've got the whole map which is just covered in black, so you can scroll off to a black area several feet away or several hundred meters away from where you are. In this case, you can only move around the map you can see. So at the start of the game, you've got no concept of how big what you're going to be doing is actually, you start off like in the first mission in a courtyard.
It's like a real fog of war instead of...
Yeah, that's right. You start off in the courtyard of a night house, and that's what you can only see, that courtyard, and eventually you get onto the wall and you start following the wall around, and you know, the map grows as the game develops, and quite dynamically as well. Like, you don't even realise there's more path over there until it actually reveals it. So
yeah.
That was good. For me, what let it down was the fact that I had trouble with it on my machine. The fact that the base building mechanic in it was, you know, better than Dawn of War 2, but still only a shadow of Dawn of War 1. And I really like base building. I really like tech trees. And yeah, some people just like unit tactics. I am a
base builder.
So yeah. And the other thing really is just the micromanagement of the units. Just the fact that it can be hard to work out.
Micromanaging of units is always my big bugbear with RTSs. The more there is, the less inclined I am to play that RTS.
Yeah,
it's just the way it is. So, we'll see.
So, in terms of, you know, should you buy it? My suggestion would be wait till it drops in price on Steam,
or at least until they've patched some of the problems with software.
Yeah, but I mean, the patching really is just, but that'll address the stability issues. Really, yeah. It's not going to, they're not going to patch in more base building mechanics or less micromanagement.
But they will patch in the stability issues. Is a big thing for a lot of people. Yeah, you know, it's a big thing for me. If I buy a game and I can only play it 20% of the time, I'm going to feel like I got ripped off.
Yeah. Okay. So, in other words, wait until it's dropped in price a bit. I'd say that's when I'd be looking to get it. You know. And try to find, the campaign's good, but try to find people to do multiplayer with as well, because multiplayer in those games is always fun. And they have said that the first patch will include new multiplayer modes as well.
So wait
to see what those are. Alright then, let's get on to the final discussion.
Ignorance is a blessing. The data you requested is unavailable.
Alright, in this discussion, what I wanted to talk about is managing the flow of time in your game. Alright, because I've played games where we pretty much played through every hour or every minute of every hour of every day of the characters' lives, and given that we only these days get to play, you know, at best once a fortnight, you know, it takes us a year to cover a week, you know, or a couple of weeks. A year of real time to cover a couple of weeks of game time. And I played games where we've skipped ahead huge amounts of time, especially games like when I was running Dark Ages, where it was designed to be one where, okay, now it's 1889, so now it's 1946, you know, it's like we're jumping ahead to key points in time as such, and I think that both things can work, but both aspects require different sort of management, and I think that's one of those things that, once again, is part of the player contract. If you have an idea about how you want the game to go, which is different from the group, this can cause problems.
Yeah.
So I'm going to use a couple of examples from recent games that I've been involved in as well. So, first one is Game of Thrones, the Song of Ice and Fire role-playing game by Greg Ronan. I've mentioned it before, I really like this game setting. It has a base building mechanic. It has tech trees. But it does have the fact that you build a house and you manage a house. And the house has a monthly upkeep thing where you actually go, you roll a dice, you start new projects, you plan things out. And some of those projects might be, we're going to build a castle. It's going to take
96 months.
Yeah, that's right. It's going to take the best part of 10 years to build this castle and such.
Yeah.
But then you've got the situation where because the game is so intrigue-based, every moment those characters aren't asleep, they want to be doing exactly what they're doing. So it could take you a long time to even get to your very first role. So it's like, okay, a couple of Game of Thrones I started off with, okay, the group is organising a tournament. The tournament's in 2 months' time. And it's like, we've never gotten anywhere near the tournament because the rate at which the players want to play the game, because of the intrigue aspect, is so minutia-focused as such.
Yeah, you've got travel time. Travel time is your real killer in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, in any sort of...
medieval setting, travel time, you can do it in 40K as well, because if you've got to travel between worlds, there you go, that's several months gone right there, potentially. Yeah.
Oh, okay, well, you've gotten to the next point early, but let's address that now, okay? So, let's imagine I'm running my Game of Thrones game, okay? And for these three game sessions, we get to cover off 4 days of actual game time, okay? Yep. So we're covering off all the things that are happening, all this intrigue and such. And each of those game sessions, I award experience points, okay? So, I don't remember the ratio of experience points in that game. Let's just say I give 9 experience points for those... For those three sessions and such, and so the characters have got 9 points in 4 days. Then the next session we say, okay, you guys ride to the event. That getting there takes you 20 days, nearly 3 weeks on the road to reach this event. In that 20 days, you've earned 0 XP, because you get to the event and now you start role playing it out and you might earn XP for that. And some players sort of question that as such, and I want to address that because that actually relates to the way that human beings actually do
learn
and gain experience as such, this comes from, years of management courses and such, but you probably heard that most people have what we call a comfort zone, all right? So the comfort zone is what an individual person is comfortable and capable of doing regularly without any real sort of challenge as such. And when a person operates inside their comfort zone, they rarely develop because, if you're very good at spreadsheets, doing lots of spreadsheets doesn't necessarily make you even better at spreadsheets. And it's until you actually try to come up with something you can't do, which pushes you outside your comfort zone. In management, you sort of accept that just outside the comfort zone is what's known as the learning zone, which is where you've now moved into a point where you're challenged, but because of the challenge, you're able to develop yourself as such. So a person riding from their home to an event or on a starship going from where they last investigated to where they're going to now will have less opportunity for personal development because they don't have the opportunity to challenge themselves. Now, you get players all the time that say, but my ship's got a librarian. I spend the entire journey, learning new things from the librarian. I should get experience points for that as well. There is the whole thing of all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. People require downtime as well, and it's been it hardest for me in my Scion game. Okay, because in my Scion game, I created a time constraint. I said, okay, it's now April in the game or May in the game. Something bad is going to happen in February of the following year. So that gives you 8 or so months to actually resolve all these things and such. Now, because the group was sort of focusing on a day by day, and it was a game where they could get the ability to no longer require sleep, that that they were finished collecting everything they needed to by, let's say, August. So there was really no the imperative wasn't there. It wasn't an imperative. I had to actually ramp the time frame up as such in order to create
some tension.
Any sort of tension as such.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the problem, is when you do go and create a time limit, the players want to use as much of that time as they can. They'll want to maximise their effectiveness in that time. They won't want to say, my character can clearly only sleep 4 hours a day if I put my mind to it and do all this extra research. So I almost think that when you want to set time limits, they need to be
realistic.
Yeah, or very short. Yeah, the only way to create real tension is to create very short time frames and let people make the most of every single minute and every hour of every day, because they've only got 4 days to solve this problem. Yeah. That's a better way of creating tension than a distant target, which you really can't anticipate the group's ability to respond to over a long period of time.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of issues, and hit the nail on the head there. You have to make sure the time frames are very tight.
Yeah.
Another issue you get is also, relating back to the experience thing, is the mastery within 3 days thing.
Yeah.
You know, the person is earning so much XP each session, and each session is a couple of days, and they've gone from not knowing a single thing about sword fighting to being the master swordsman, and it's only taken them 2 weeks because they've spent all their XP.
Yeah, but they had a montage.
Oh, they had a training montage. You've got to be careful with giving out lots of XP in short order as well. And like you said, I mean, you don't earn XP for just travelling around and sitting around doing nothing. Yeah. If you did, every time you met someone who was 2 years older than you, you'd be absolutely outmatched in every possible way.
Yeah.
Because they've had 2 extra years of learning everything.
That's another excellent point. This is something about particularly the 40K universe, is that... it's in 40K, it's in other settings as well, it's in D&D. So you've got, in these games, races that have hugely different lifespans.
Yep.
Okay, so you might meet an Eldar in the game, okay, and that Eldar has stats that are, you know, +0 or +10 in some of their skills and such, whereas you, a human, who's lived only a fraction of their life, have the same, or in some cases, better. You know, you get the same in D&D. You know, you create a first-level elf, you're 120 years old, and you know just as much as a first-level human of the same class. Depending on your intelligence bonus, obviously, which is they get the same points on. So, once again, how do you justify that? And the way that I usually say to deal with that is to say that these incredibly long-lived races are more prone to spending a lot of their time in that comfort zone.
Yeah.
You know, because they don't have the time imperative to get out and do things that that shorter-lived races do.
That's it. When you're immortal, you don't have to go out and do things to make sure your name's remembered, because you've only got 30 years before you die. You know, there's a huge difference there, and I think that fits it, yeah.
Yeah, so that they still live just as much. They just do less that challenges and develops them, because they don't have the requirement to...
There's also the fact that, you know... It's like vampires in the old vampire game. People used to go, oh, well, these elders have been around for hundreds of years and they're not really much better than us. And I'm thinking, well, that's because they don't go out and risk their lives, because they're immortal and the only way to die is by being killed. So what do? Don't go out and get killed.
Yeah, I mean...
You guys are stupid enough to go out and fight against evil minions and monsters and demons and whatever. That's very dangerous. And it gives you lots of experience for doing so, but there's a risk versus reward situation.
It's one of the inherent problems that role players face, is that, you know, I may play a character which is effectively, is functionally immortal, or, you know, doesn't have those regular constraints, but I am a person that does. And so I tend to play a character, like, I mean, it's a fantastic role player who can have their character set up a scheme that will never be realised within the
scope of the game.
The likely played scope of the game, because that character will see the results of that scheme in 400 years' time. And we're never going to get that far, because all the other characters will be dead from old age, and the GM's only focused on this, you know, 3 years of their life. But for that character, it's perfectly reasonable to say that, you know, I'm going to put something in play now that I won't see for a few hundred years, because it's going to, the payout will be worth it at the time.
Yeah.
So yeah, as a player, we're used to playing. So every day I play a human. Like right now, I play a human at work, you know, yeah. And that's what I'm used to playing. So when I go and play something else, I still play it in the same way that a working human might.
Yeah.
That's one of the constraints. Now, there are plenty of game systems that do have mechanics for awarding XP for downtime, and we spoke in the past about things like blue booking. But you know, there is certainly, I have no problem with saying to people, okay, you can spend some of your free time doing research, but my favourite system for this was the old first edition World of Darkness Mage, which had research points, where, you know, you had the experience points you earned for actually going out and doing things, and you had points you earned from just spending your time trying to better yourself. And those points, it was more expensive to put things up with those points, but they were easy to obtain just through downtime. You can literally say to the GM, okay, we pick up in a month's time, and my character spends that time, you know, perusing through libraries and trying to find the answer to this riddle or such, and you get research points, which you can still improve your stats with, but nothing would be as fast as
going out and doing things.
Yeah, risking your life, you know, challenging opponents and such, and that was where you got the real experience points from.
Yeah.
So I always liked that particular system, and so it also comes to me with, we should do a whole segment at one point on elite advances in these settings, because in the past we've talked about how hard elite advances are to manage, especially in the older settings that had the, elite advances didn't really come into the ones that had the progression tables and such, you know, but
yeah.
They're still a consideration. But yeah, I mean, you know where I'm coming from with this, that there's, I think that we need to have a better idea and agree with our players how time is going to run in this game.
Yes.
You know, because if you have a situation where you play every day for a few sessions and then you skip forward an amount of time,
it's going to be
that can throw out players who aren't knowing how to manage it and expect that as such.
Yeah.
So, and the worst is when you've got different groups of players or different players in the group who are trying to do different things that want to have, one person says, I go and do this for a week, and then someone in the group wants to play out every day of that week what their character's doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely going to be an issue, because they're trying to monopolise the time. They're going, well, that other person's doing their research for a week.
Yeah.
So it's okay for me to monopolise your time.
Yeah. That's why it's always better in games like Call of Cthulhu to have everybody have a research task and everybody goes and does their thing or such. That's what you got to try and manage.
Yeah, and try and find ways of limiting it.
Yeah. All right, so just some food for thought. You know, what might work in your campaign? Let's go on to closing out the show.
Yep.
Or Astropath through the choir chamber. Message incoming.
So at this point in the show, we normally talk about any reviews or comments that we've received, and we have got a couple things here.
Yep.
First off, we have a new review on iTunes from Private Ryan 810. So thank you very much for that review. We also had some comments in the last month. One was a link which was shared via Twitter from Sandwich. That was that Sega, you know, in order to promote Dawn of War 3, actually built a functional power fist.
Yes.
Now, when I say functional, it didn't have a power field. It simply had a compressed air canister with 3,000 psi of pressure.
Yeah.
And they then used it, they took it around for their demonstrations, smashing fruit and other things with the power fist. Now, the problem they've got there is that a person had it on the end of their arm. And although although it's got a pneumatic press to push the fist part of it out, of course, you know, relativity tells you that if it hits a solid object, it's going to push back on the person's arm with just as much force.
Yes.
So they had to be pretty careful. They had to be pretty careful with that as well. But I'll put the link in the show notes. You can see, and there's some videos of them smashing various things with their Blood Raven's power fist. So, and they actually exported the model from the game to 3D print and make the actual object itself as well. So
yeah.
Man, it's got some serious wear and tear after its tour. So, the other thing we have is an email from Johnny, one of our regular listeners and emails as well, who said that now that we're starting to see some of the Primarchs reappearing in the war game, would we, as you and I, like to take up the challenge of trying to stat out some Primarchs in the role playing game?
Godlike beings of power.
let me take this first. The very first game I've ran of Dark Heresy, all right, was at a convention.
Yeah.
Right? So at this point in time, it was still under the Black Industries license. The only books we had at that point in time were the main book, the Inquisitor's Handbook, and the character folio. They hadn't even released. It was only the main book. They hadn't even, because that's right, because Purge the Unclean came out before the Inquisitor's Handbook, so all I had was the main book, right?
Yeah.
And I wanted to run a game of Dark Heresy at a convention. And I decided that my end opponent of this adventure was going to be an already crippled but still alive Chaos Space Marine.
Yeah.
Just to show that, you know, even when it was crippled, it was still a big risk. So I started out what I thought was this. You know, this was before the days of, well, I think, uncanny attributes work in there as such, but I think I just gave very high stats. I didn't use uncanny.
Yeah, unnatural attributes were just mole pliers. Yeah.
That's it, yeah. But anyway, I started out what I thought would be a really good opponent, and yeah, it was in that game, it was tough for the players to beat, and in a couple of games, actually, the players who played the con actually went and got their gun cutter and came back and used that the weapons on that as, you know, weapons against the Chaos Space Marine and such. Then Purge Unclean came out, and we had stats for Brother Sergeant Agamore in that. They shat all over what I produced as estimated stats for my Chaos Space Marine.
Yeah.
So I almost feel that if I was to go and stat out a Primarch, no matter how ridiculous I made it, that the reality would actually be even that's it, because Warhammer is so extreme as such.
Yeah, I mean, Primarchs, they routinely kill greater demons, smashing them over their knees and ripping their wings off.
So I'm going to default back here to a line from the old Vampire the Masquerade role-playing game when talking about people asking for the stats for Antediluvians, which is pretty much to say that there's no point saying them. Whatever they want to accomplish, they succeed in. You know, any attack against them that they don't want to hit them, won't. You know, any attempt to wound them they don't want to be wounded by, won't. I almost feel it's the same way with Primarchs, is that, you know, their stats are only relevant when they are competing with other Primarchs, in which case you may as well just use conventional game stats. Just build a Space Marine in Death Watch and say, this one's, you know, Robert Gulliman, this one's Magnus the Red, and fight them on a conventional level, because when they're compared against anything else in the setting, that their stats are irrelevant.
Yeah.
You know, if they don't want to be hurt, they can't be. If they want you dead, you're already dead. Yeah. So
yeah, that I can't remember which game setting it was. I think it might have actually been Rift. And there were situations where you had things with thousands of mega damage, throwing out thousands of mega damage, and you're just like, well, why am I tracking such large numbers? Divide everything by 1,000.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, go back to the old West End Star Wars game system. It was a simple rule that, you know, every time you jumped up a scale, you multiply the number of dice.
Yeah.
So, you know, a Death Star laser against a player character was just an enormously stupid number of dice. But the same Death Star laser against a capital ship was actually dicey roll because, you know, it was a chance that what you actually rolled mattered.
Yeah. It never did. I always found that odd because it was possible to shoot the Death Star laser at a planet and not destroy the planet.
Yeah.
Well, I have to fire it twice.
Okay, we'll look at more recently the Star Wars FFG system. You effectively have a multiplier of 10 when you go from personal scale to ship scale because, you know, if you're shot by a ship gunner at 1 point of damage, you'll take 10 points of damage. If you want to damage a ship, you need to do at least 10 points of damage to count as one ship point. Same as mega damage was 100 to 1 in Rifts.
Or it's 1,000 to 1.
Maybe you're
right. Yeah, it was
1,000 to 1. It's a while ago now since I picked that up, because I've got Savage Rifts to play now if I want to play Rifts. So anyway, I'm sorry to disappoint Johnny. Yeah, I could, as a joke, put together stats for a Primarch, but I think it would. I don't think I could actually produce something that I would feel comfortable with saying this is what a Primarch stat should be like.
Yeah, I think you're right. Whatever they want to do, they can do.
Yeah.
In most cases.
Exactly. Unless
it involves, it only really matters when it's Primarch versus Primarch.
Exactly.
Primarch versus anything less than Primarch, they're probably going to win. Yeah. Unless it's something like Primarch versus Great Demon, in which case they might take a bit of a beating and then win.
Yeah. Okay, so if you do want to contact us, there's many ways to do so. Our website is www.grimdarkpodcast.com. Let me just quickly cut in and say, the website was redone recently, and we still appreciate that, there's a login thing at the right-hand side of the page where you can create an account and log in. That's what we use to log into the website and update it. We have no other user-facing features for creating an account. I get a lot of account applications coming through on email for people that have created an account on the website. There were quite a few I worked out were spam bots, but, you know, a lot of them I look at the names and think, okay, that sounds like a 40k player, you know, but based upon his username and such. I appreciate your interest in the website. Right now there is no other user facing content you get from logging in, so alright, our Facebook page is facebook.com/grimdartpodcast. Our Google Plus page is plus.google.com/+grimdartpodcast. We tweet through @grimdartpodcast, and our email is show@grimdartpodcast.com. As always, don't forget the voicemail link on our website on the right-hand side if you want to leave us a voice message, which we haven't gotten now for 2 or so years, I think, was the last one we got. And I'm still paying for the account every year. Anyway, coming up, episode 83, It's a Death Watch show. Now that the voting is in, we'll be doing the first part of our interactive Death Watch story.
So we've got the votes in?
Yes.
They're all decided?
Yes.
You're not going to fudge results?
No, I'm not going to fudge results.
Okay.
I think the results are public anyway, so I couldn't if I wanted to without going and doing a whole bunch of extra voting.
Okay.
Yeah, so we'll have to make sure if we're going to get our shouty voice on, yeah, so we sound like Space Marines. Anyway. We were talking about the Storm Wardens. Since we've covered off the rest of the chapters, key chapters in the book, so we'll talk about the Storm Wardens, and we might even talk a bit about the whole thing behind the non-canon chapters as such, or the semi-canon chapters like Blood Ravens.
They're canon chapters, but they're non-Games Workshop chapters, yeah, I suppose. Right. They're not created by Games Workshop, they're created by other companies which are licensed by Games Workshop.
So we'll talk about those a bit more in what we did on this episode. The rest I'm not sure what we'll do yet, but we will make sure we have a complete show. Hopefully sooner than a month and a half away.
Yes.
But I can tell you, I'm definitely coming for the next 3 weeks, so it's going to be hard in that time, but we'll see what we can organise. Anyway, thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. It's good to get back on the horse again and keep it going. Mike, thank you for taking part.
No problems.
And we will see you all next time.
Thank you very much.
This podcast is not endorsed by or affiliated with Games Workshop or Fantasy Flight Games. Warhammer 40,000, Dark Heresy, Rogue Trader, Death Watch, Black Crusade, Only War, Eternal Crusade, and all associated properties are trademark and or copyright of Games Workshop Limited. Fantasy Flight Games is a trademark of Fantasy Flight Publishing Inc. All other materials are trademark and or copyright of their respective owners. All original content is copyright of the Grimdark Podcast. All rights are reserved by their respective owners. Our theme music comes from Mevio's Media Galley, music.mevio.com.